and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's visit to Vietnam and the announcement that the U.S. is lifting its arms embargo on Vietnam, a move that is widely interpreted as a response to China's territorial encroachment into the South China Sea, which the Vietnamese call the East Sea. First, we will speak with Professor Hung Nguyen, Emeritus Professor of East Asian Studies and a Professor of Government and International Affairs at George Mason University. He joins us to discuss how the Vietnamese view the expansionist activities of China and whether those concerns are greater than the economic and Communist Party to Communist Party ties that are being made between Vietnam and China, which is Vietnam's biggest trading partner. Then we get a broader strategic view of Obama's agenda with Vietnam and the extent to which the TPP and lifting the arms embargo are a response to China's territorial encroachment deep into Vietnamese and Philippine waters. Alfred McCoy, Chair of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, joins us to discuss the protein wars, which are a result of China having fished out its waters as it now launches a military-style invasion of the rich fishing grounds between Vietnam and the Philippines with massive fishing fleets in coordination with the Chinese Navy. Then finally, we'll examine the remarks made by the head of the World Health Organization that the Zika epidemic is both the fault of governments that abandoned mosquito eradication and failed to provide birth control to young women in poor countries. With Congress delaying funding for 90 days after lowballing Obama's request of $1.9 billion down to $622 million for mosquito eradication in the southern states and to find a vaccine for Zika, we will speak with Dr. Peter Katona, a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, to see if there is a way forward to deal with this alarming epidemic. And joining us now is Hung Nguyen, who's a professor of government and international relations at George Mason University. And he's currently a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hung Nguyen.
Hi.
And the President Obama has made an historic visit to Vietnam, and of course much of the coverage and emphasis is on the idea that we're finally healing the wounds of the Vietnam War. But what seemed to have gotten most of the headline attention is the lifting of the arms embargo that was predicated upon Vietnam improving its human rights situation. So let's begin with that. Clearly, the arms embargo lifting has a lot to do, surely, with China's activities in what's called the South China Sea, that the Vietnamese refer to as the East Sea.
Yes, exactly.
And what's your sense then of how aggressive the Chinese are in that area, and short of the UN tribunal that is judging the case, which I believe Vietnam and the Philippines have joined efforts in, nothing seems to be stopping the Chinese. They seem to be getting more and more aggressive.
Well, the Chinese has been aggressive, aggressively imposing its will on the South China Sea. She draws the 9 dash lines, covering 80% of the sea, and she has, you know, she have imposed unilateral fishing ban. She has removed, she have moved some of the big oil rig into Vietnam economic zone. She already have started building and militarizing those islands, that artificial island. So she has been, you know, basically create a fait accompli that radically changing the balance of power in that area. So that could be a concern for the Vietnamese as well as for the United States.
So how much, though, is China filling a vacuum? There was recently a report that the Philippines had an opportunity to put a lighthouse on Scarborough Reef, which is actually very close to the Philippines. But now China got in ahead of them and put down what they called a weather station that's manned by members of the People's Liberation Army, and it's clearly not exactly a civilian operation. And my understanding was that the decision to build the lighthouse, which would have staked a claim, if you will, by the Philippines, was vetoed by a corrupt Filipino politician who was trying to curry favor with the Chinese. So is this a case of China filling a vacuum?
Well, China has been filling the vacuum there. Now, the Scarborough incident took place years ago, 2012, and the Philippines were driven out of the place. And because of the Chinese have prevented the Philippines to join back, come back, return to the zone, which the Philippines claimed belonged to there. And now because the Chinese activity on the Scarborough zone, that is concerned not only to the Philippines, but also to America that have, access to the ways in the Philippines, which is only 200 kilometers from the shore.
Well, that's what's so extraordinary about it, that the Scarborough Shoal is closer to the Philippines than just about anything. It's certainly much closer that the Paracel Islands are to China, and the Spratlys are even way to the south.
Exactly. That's why China, has been criticized being having an excessive claim of territorial jurisdiction.
But it's not just the islands that they're claiming. It's the vast amount of
exactly.
water around them, right? That they
Well, they have not made very clear what they claim. They only draw the nine dash line and claiming the whole island in there belong to them. So the implication is that they claim own the water. But that has not been clear by the Chinese, and people have tried to ask her to clarify what does it mean by, what is Chinese, what is content of the nine dash line.
So what's your sense then of how the government of Vietnam sees this? I know, the UN tribunal is looking into it, and that Vietnam has joined with the Philippines in bringing this case forward. The Chinese press is full of denunciations of the UN tribunal. Mm-hmm. But if the UN tribunal were to rule in Vietnam's favor or in the Philippines' favor, what difference would it make to the Chinese? Isn't their occupation of these islands a fait accompli?
Basically, the suit was brought by the Philippines, not by the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese indicated to the tribunal that she had an interest in the case, so not really a litigation. So that's one thing about that.
Right, friend of the court, yeah.
Yeah. The second thing is that if the court decided, if the fight is available for the Philippines, then I think, theoretically, it can offer an off-ramp for the Chinese if she wants to back down. So that's one possibility. The Chinese, before the tribunal, have accused it and said that they would ignore the courses. But the idea now for many countries is that, there's a term that shame fair, that instead of going to warfare, they have shame fair, making the Chinese ashamed of what she's doing in the front of public opinion court.
So in terms of the Vietnam government, do you think that they are concerned about China's flexing its muscles, both territorially, economically? I mean, it was back in 1979, the end of the Vietnam War, that there was a bloody border war between Vietnam and China, mm-hmm. which the Chinese didn't do too well. And basically, at that point, the indications were, I remember reading about it, that, there's a history of, in fact, arguably, Vietnam's entire history has been about resisting Chinese invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
That's a long time. Yes, that is very true. As a matter of fact, the war took place in 1979, that ended, but not really ended, because in 1984, there's been bloody barren between the two countries. But they mend fences, in 1991 when they normalized diplomatic relations between two countries.
So, but in terms of how the Vietnamese view China. How do they view China? I mean, first of all, you've got a bit of a disconnect here. You've got fear of Chinese expansion in the South China Sea, or the East Sea, as the Vietnamese call it. But it also is a fact that China is Vietnam's biggest trading partner.
Yes, I mean, Vietnam-China relationship is a complex relationship. It's of love-hate relationship. Now, Vietnam and China share common ideology, a common communist systems, and they also share, you know, land border. They're very close. They were allies before, and they are now, you know, neighbors. So, and the Chinese is a bigger neighbor. So for the Vietnamese, there's always suspicion of Chinese intention. Historically, China has invaded Vietnam several times, and currently, China has been making claim and carry out activities that are encroaching upon Vietnam territorial integrity. So, you know, China and Vietnam have to think about that. You know, it's a national threat. But on the other hand, you know, as you said, Vietnam is dependent on Chinese. China is big market, biggest market for Vietnam. And Vietnam also imports a lot from China. So there's a relationship of economic dependency. The other one is a relationship between parties, not only between the government and government, but also between the parties. But I think, so there's on one hand, there's a link, the link that makes them closer, and the other one, there is issues that drive them apart. Currently, I think the factor that drives them apart is larger, stronger than the factors that keep them together.
And again, I'm speaking with Hung Nguyen, who's Professor Emeritus of East Asian Studies at George Mason University, and he's currently a Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. So given that you think that the concerns over China's expansion into what the Vietnamese calls the East Sea is a stronger factor than the trading relation.
Yes.
And even though, as you say, there's not just government-to-government relations between China and Vietnam, there's also Communist Party-to-Communist Party relations. But, of course, what's happening in China is that Xi Jinping is trying to consolidate the power of the Communist Party and revive Mao Zedong in a way, even though his own family suffered during the Cultural Revolution. So there's a sort of paradoxical situation going on in China itself, but it does have a lot of people alarmed. But meanwhile, Vietnam has bought a number of submarines from Russia. They've also bought some, I think there's 6-kilo-class submarines from Russia, and they bought a large number of patrol vessels, missile ships, and fighter jets also. So Vietnam is spending money on weapons from Russia. But now that the U.S. has lifted the arms embargo, it's pretty clear that the Vietnamese would like to have more modern and much more capable weapons that the U.S. has, the top-of-the-line weaponry. But how could they ever pay for it? I mean, they're doing well. They're an emerging economy. But they don't have the kind of money that you'd need to buy a lot of American weaponry.
They don't, and they are not going to buy right away. But, you know, if they have security need, they would do it. But it's not as easy as I once said. The embargo is lifted. In theory, it is a symbolic act. But to buy whatever the Vietnamese buy, it have to go through the process approved by the United States. And then the issue of human rights will come to play. So it's not just, you know, whatever they want to buy, they can buy. But no, it would take some time. And because of that, you know, it all depends on their needs. And if they have the need, they have to find the money. And also, you know, they also can, you know, they can be getting loan or something like that. It all depends, you know. I would say the strategic interest of both countries.
So do you feel that the United States in any way has lost its leverage over human rights pressure on Vietnam by lifting the arms embargo?
Not really, because there are a lot of other things. Take, for example, if Vietnam is going, Vietnam already have signed on to the TPP, and TPP have a lot of condition about human rights, especially workers' rights. And the United States already have asked Vietnam to prepare, to observe that right, and to make law that would be compatible with the implementation of TPP. U.S. also is willing to help Vietnam, if she wanted to set up, you know, to have draw up the legislative, the legal structure to carry it out. So it's still there, and the leverage is still there, even because, you know, when the Vietnamese wanted to buy something for U.S., she he would have to go through the process of human rights assessments. And as a matter of fact, you know, I understand that before the joint press conference, President Obama had a discussion with President Quang of Vietnam, and the discussion was very, very active, and Obama have made very clear the American concern by human rights. And when he go to the press conference, he didn't say that much, because you know what he say in personally with the president is different from what he say outside. Basically, what it means that President Obama was very concerned about human rights too, and he make it clear to the Vietnamese government. And in the response, you can see that President Quang also said he admitted there was human rights issues. Then he said that the two sides would have to solve it, you know, gradually and based on mutual respect and mutual understanding. So, you know, the Vietnamese also was, you know, recognized of the need for human rights observance as far as the relation with the United States is concerned. So Obama has not dropped that yet. However, in relation between country to countries, human rights issues, value issue, only play second fiddle to the more overwhelming strategic and economic interests of a country.
So what's your understanding of the human rights situation? Because there are a lot of people in jail, political prisoners, etc., in Vietnam. And when President Quang, who did seem a little uncomfortable when human rights issues were talked about, said that this was a gradual process. Well, if you're sitting in prison and you're a political prisoner, a gradual doesn't sound very encouraging.
No, because the human rights situation now is not as good. Now, if you compare to the time when President Bush visited Vietnam in 2006, the human rights situation in Vietnam is worse. But common strategic interest between the two countries is stronger now.
Right.
Because of Chinese activity.
Right, because of China. So mm-hmm. Arguably, China is driving the U.S. and Vietnam together.
Exactly.
Do you think they're aware of that, the Chinese, that maybe this whole...
The Chinese was aware of that, but the point is that, you know, for the Chinese, it's a question of timing. China wanted to dominate the South China Sea. If she doesn't do now, when the country of Asian are divided, she may lose out, because eventually, with time, the ASEAN countries would maybe getting stronger, more united, and their border to move to the United States. And United also have time to consolidate, strengthen the allies and partner in the area. By that time, it will be too late for China to occupy the whole area. So the timing for Chinese also important. I think she understand the cost, you know, diplomatic cost. But for some reason, she's moving. So it's quite a question of choice for the Chinese leadership.
Right, but you're saying that China wants to occupy all of this region. So that's definitely suggesting that China is on an aggressive strategy here, and that the idea is that the ASEAN countries are going to wake up too late before it's a fait accompli. Now, that does seem to be the case with these islands. But how much further can China take it?
Well, it all depends on two things. Number one, the resolutions of the countries of the Asian group, I mean the 10 countries, to stand together to make a strong stand against the Chinese encroachment. That is one way. The other one is a commitment of the major country that included India, Japan, and United States to the freedom of the sea. And they recently, you can see that a series of FONOP operations in that area show that at least as far as the U.S. is concerned, she has determined not to accede to the control, total control over the South China Sea to the Chinese. The Japanese also have done that. And recently, I think, in a reluctant way, the Indian also, you know, began to join the game.
So then, just in closing, Hung Nguyen, do you think the TPP, which is obviously President Obama's initiative, and this pivot to Asia, is really about containing China because there's a concern of Chinese expansion?
The U.S. would say that. You know, other people don't like to use a different term. Rather than containing, we talk about hatching.
Say that again.
Hatching
what?
Against
hatching?
Hedging, yes.
Oh, hedging.
Hedging rather than containing. They don't want to use that terms.
Right.
But, you know, publicly the United States said the TPP is a different, you know, a new standard of international trade. And by the treaty, the United States and other countries was able to set, you know, the new standard for trade rather than, you know, they have to be tied up with the old WTO regulations and where many countries have violated.
Well, Hung Nguyen, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate your information you've given us.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Hung Nguyen, who's Professor of Government and International Relations at George Mason University. And he's currently a Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with a broader strategic view of Obama's agenda with Vietnam. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alfred McCoy, a Tom Dispatch regular who holds a Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and he's the author of The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia and Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alfred McCoy.
Thank you, Ian. A pleasure to be back.
And likewise, it's good to have you back, Al. And I was just speaking with Professor Hung Nguyen of George Mason and now at CSIS, and we talked about the concern in Vietnam over China's encroachment into the South China Sea that the Vietnamese refer to as the East Sea, and the extent to which what the Chinese have done is pretty much a fait accompli. Is that your sense, that they've really got the jump on the rest of the countries, particularly the Philippines and Vietnam?
Well, the Pentagon came out with a report not long ago saying that by 2030, the South China Sea will be a Chinese lake, that they will have effectively completed their acquisition of the South China Sea. And they have this historic claim, the famous nine-dotted line that goes back to the 1950s, right at not long after the origins of the People's Republic of China, and they lay claim to virtually the entire South China Sea. That should have been overridden by the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, known as UNCLOS, which gives all of the sovereign states bordering the South China Sea a 200-mile exclusive zone of economic exploitation. But China persists in its claim to the South China Sea. And that means that, as far as Vietnam is concerned, most of the land that the small islands that China claims are in the Paracels, and it's there that China has been building its most extensive base. China is converting a couple islands in the Paracels and about seven islands in the Spratly Islands, right in the middle of the South China Sea. It has an armada of dredges that churn the seabed and transform these reefs and atolls into actual islands. And it's at Woody Island, where the process has been most complete. It's now got an airstrip capable of handling jet fighters, and in February of this year, China made what looked like a non-violent, non-threatening move by putting HQ-9 surface-to-air missiles, anti-air missiles, on that reef. There are now aerial photographs available online where you can see the Woody Island right next to the runway. There are these batteries of HQ-9 missiles, and those are defensive missiles. So that didn't raise too many flags internationally, but it gives China, if you will, control over the air in the paracels and consolidates China's claim to waters that Vietnam should, under international law, be able to consider its own.
Well, of course, just if you're looking at a map, Alfred McCoy, the Woody Islands and the paracels are sort of equidistant, I think, from Hainan, which is part of China, and Vietnam. But there's no question that the Spratlys, way to the south, are very much closer to the Philippines than anything else, and they're much.
Oh, they're right in the middle of the Spratlys. Most of the Spratlys are right in the center of the Philippine 200-mile exclusive zone of economic exploitation.
Right, and then on the other end, and much closer to Vietnam. But this raises this question about the Scarborough Shoal, which is to the north, very close to the Philippines. And my understanding is that the Filipinos dropped the ball. They were going to put a lighthouse on there, and some corrupt politician vetoed it because he was currying favor with the Chinese. And the Chinese moved in and put in a weather station manned by the PLA. And that seems to be their MO, to make it a fait accompli and then say, sorry, we're here first. So have they got the jump on everybody else?
Actually, yeah, but this has been going on much longer than anybody realizes. Look, what happened was, back in 1991, at the close of the Cold War, the Philippine Senate voted by a very narrow margin to reject a renewal of the bases treaty with the United States that gave the U.S. access to the Subic Bay. Subic Bay was the biggest U.S. naval base outside the United States. It was a massive bastion. It had wharves that could actually handle aircraft carriers. It had floating dry docks. It had hardened pens for nuclear submarines. It had a naval air station, Kubi Point Air Station. And that was built starting in 1952 at the cost of $170 million U.S. dollars. It was one of the biggest U.S. construction projects in U.S. history. And the Philippine Senate canceled that. And then under the Ramos administration that followed, there was the announcement of a massive modernization of the Philippine Armed Forces. That never took place. So in 1994, in the midst of a typhoon, the Chinese came in and occupied the first of those reefs in the Spratlys. So they just sort of insert themselves. So it's this relentless erosion of everybody else's sovereignty. They come in, at a moment of weakness, insert themselves, and then consolidate that claim. And they've done that throughout the South China Sea. And so now that they've got about seven bases that they're finishing up in the Spratlys, and they have Woody Island, and that gives them, along with their what are called aircraft carrier killer missiles based in China itself, they've also got a nuclear submarine pens on Hailan Island, Longpo Naval Base. So the combination of the missile defenses, the armada of tactical fighters, the nuclear submarines, they're consolidating their claim. And the Pentagon is projecting that China is going to be building a flotilla of small light aircraft carriers that will give it dominance in the South China Sea. And the question then is, what is this all about? What's at stake? And there's, I think, several things. First of all, China is one of those empires. Hannah Arendt argued that empires expand two ways. One, overseas, the classic maritime empires like Spain, Holland, Great Britain at its apogee, and then the other type of empire, those that spread overland into contiguous territories. Well, China is one of those empires that spreads into contiguous territories. They took over Tibet, and then they fabricated an historic claim to Tibetan sovereignty. They're now pushing into the adjacent South China Sea, the East China Sea, They're very aggressive in their relations with the adjacent nations of Southeast Asia. They're launched a multi-billion-dollar project 2 years ago to build a combined road, rail, and pipeline corridor from western China through Pakistan to the Arabian Sea. And at Gwadar, the former fishing village in Balochistan in Pakistan on the Arabian Sea, the Chinese spent $200 billion to transform that fishing village into a modern port. And that port is just 350 miles from the mouth of the Persian Gulf. So the combination of Gwadar in Pakistan and these bases in the South China Sea gives the People's Republic of China the capacity to slice through the circles of steel that the United States has built ringing the Eurasian landmass since the start of the Cold War back in the 1940s that involved massive military bases like Subic Bay, which is one of the anchors of that encirclement, layer upon layer of military alliances stretching from NATO in Western Europe all the way to the ANZUS Alliance and the Philippine-U.S. Mutual Security Treaty and the U.S.-Japan Mutual Security Treaty, and now a semicircle of 60 drone bases that stretch from Sicily in the Mediterranean through the Indian Ocean all the way to Anderson Air Force Base on the island of Guam in the Western Pacific. And but with the combination of the bases and the Spratlys and the Paracels and Gwadar, China can now slice through that semicirclement that the United States has layered to ringing the Eurasian landmass. The other part of the Obama's strategy is not only rebuilding the U.S. strategic position, stretching from Darwin, Australia, all the way to Japan, but also the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP Treaty. And there are a dozen nations, including Vietnam and the United States, that have signed this treaty. And if it comes to pass, it will attempt to cut China's dominance of the Eurasian landmass, sort of splitting it at the Urals and draining it of its economic substance by redirecting 40% of world's trade under the Trans-Pacific Partnership toward the United States. And then there's another parallel treaty, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, that will redirect something like 17% of the world's trade that's controlled by the European Union. The sum of those two treaties will drain the Eurasian landmass and direct 60% of the world's trade towards the United States. And so when Obama came to Vietnam, Vietnam is one of the key pieces in this strategy. And Obama's announcement involved two things. He said it had nothing to do with China. Of course, it has everything to do with China. But in his statement, he said nothing to do with China. Okay, and the first part is Vietnam is an active member of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The United States is Vietnam's largest export market among all the countries of the world. Trade is now about $45 billion between the two nations and growing very, very fast, double-digit growth. And so that's one part of it, and there's a big deal. Boeing is going to sell 100 737s to Vietnam. General Electric is going to be selling wind generators, et cetera. So it's a fairly high-level trade and fairly good export market for the United States. So that's one part. And then the second part is he also ended the U.S. arms embargo to Vietnam and allowing the United States to provide Vietnam probably with eventually high-level avionics and maybe strategic aircraft, fighters and the like. So it's got a military and an economic component, which, of course, are the complementary aspects of Obama's strategy for countering and containing China.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Alfred McCoy, when we last spoke, you said that there was also, not only were the Chinese occupying these islands for strategic and military reasons, they were also, of course, they lay claim to the oil, if there's any oil there. But more importantly, they lay claim to all of the world's richest fishing grounds, which are off Vietnam and the Philippines. And so what do the local people think about this? I mean, not only you're losing your sovereignty to China, but you may lose your food supply as well.
Well, Yeah, remember, and this is something most people don't realize, of course, you know, human diet requires two things. One, carbohydrates, which in the case of the Vietnamese is rice. It's a whole grain, where we've been historically a wheat-based society. China's a wheat and rice society. So that's one part, but every society needs protein. The United States has multiple sources of protein because we have large herds of beasts, pigs, sheep, and particularly cattle. Well, the people surrounding the South China Sea don't have beasts for protein. Yes, there's some pigs, there's some fowl, but what they've relied upon historically is fish. The poor person's diet among all the civilizations surrounding the South China Sea, Philippines and Vietnam, for example, is trash fish, not the big pelagics that go to the rich people, but it's the small little fish that you scoop up in the nets. And both societies have ways of transforming these fish into fish sauce. So in the Philippines and Vietnam, when poor people sit down to have their meal three times a day, they generally have rice and they dip it into a fish sauce. In the case of Vietnam, it's called Nuoc Mam, an incredibly pungent, rather tasty sauce, actually, a very pungent smell. This is the poor man's protein, and that's fish. And this is central to Vietnamese civilization, central to the survival. So the South China Sea is one of the five richest fishing grounds on the planet. It has more varieties of fish than any other place on the planet. You could make a case that it's even the world's richest fishing ground. The Chinese themselves eat 80 pounds of fish a year. Well, they fished out the northern waters of the South China Sea, and the Chinese have about 92,000 fishing boats that are actually paramilitary in their organization that are following the Chinese Navy and are integrated with them in this big push. And right now they're working, the prime fishing grounds are right in the Philippines, the Philippine zone of the South China Sea, the Malaysia zone. They're pushing into the southern fringes of the South China Sea. So when the current president of the Philippines, recently elected, is talking about amicable relations with China, what he is forfeiting, of course, which I don't think he's aware of, is the protein that ordinary Filipinos are going to need to survive into the 21st century. So it's serious. It's very serious.
Well, Alfred McCoy, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alfred McCoy, who is a Time Dispatch regular. He holds the Harrington Chair in History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is the editor of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, and is the author of The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia and Policing America's Empire, the United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State. We take a brief station break. We're back looking into remarks by the head of the World Health Organization that the Zika epidemic is a fault of governments that abandoned mosquito eradication and failed to provide contraception to young women in poor countries. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Peter Katona, who is a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He has worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as an EIS officer, studying viral diseases and doing epidemic investigations. And he has held appointments at Louisiana State University's National Center for Biomedical Research and Training and the Los Angeles County Emergency Management Services Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Peter Katona.
Glad to be here.
And the head of the World Health Organization has just basically said that the Zika virus is our own fault, in effect, saying that efforts to eradicate mosquitoes back in the 60s and 70s were largely successful. But since then, the world powers, if you will, have dropped the ball. And I don't know how much she's blaming the U.S. It seems to be a sort of a general blanket blame that more could have been done in terms of mosquito eradication. So is that your understanding?
Well, it's a complicated area, and you know, you can spend money on mosquito eradication, on tick eradication, on parasite eradication for malaria, and when something doesn't seem to be going well, you can always blame not having done enough. So it's really hard to kind of justify the blame one way or the other. We can certainly always do more with mosquito eradication, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other priorities as well for global health when it comes to a lot of outbreaks. Ebola had nothing to do with mosquitoes, for example. Flu outbreaks have nothing to do with mosquitoes. So it's a very complicated answer to who is going to get the most blame for this.
So, but surely the fact that the Congress, for the last something like 90 days, have been sitting on President Obama's request for $1.9 billion to find a way to immunize people against Zika and also to do more research into it, because it's obviously a lot is not known and understood. But also a big chunk of that money was for mosquito eradication, particularly in the southern states, where the Aegypti mosquito is present. So given what Dr. Chen, the head of the World Health Organization, said today, and the fact that the Congress is only offering up $662 million instead of $1.9 billion, much of which, of course, is again, is dedicated to mosquito eradication, is she trying to send a signal to the Congress?
Possibly. I mean, this is certainly a political hot potato, and a lot of the issues here are much more politically driven than driven by science or whether there's a need for it. You know, $1.9 billion is a lot of money, but probably necessary for this. I mean, if you look at the entire CDC budget, it's about $7 billion. So this is a fairly large chunk of money. And, you know, how we prepare, you know, how prepared we are, how prepared we need to be, you know, what can we do in an ideal world, it's really hard to actually place a financial cost to that. But I certainly feel that a lot of money should be spent, because this could erupt into something that could be much more damaging to us.
So, but we do understand, don't we, that the Aedes aegypti mosquito is the vector for Zika.
It's one of the two vectors. There's two different Aedes species that can transmit this disease in the real world. And are there other mosquitoes that can also theoretically transmit it but aren't actually transmitters in the real world, like a Culex mosquito?
And sexual transmission, explain that, because that's also recently emerged.
Well, like Ebola, because nobody expected this to be a problem with Ebola as well, which can also be sexually transmitted, we found that you know, it only lives a short time in the blood, the actual virus itself. It lives a little longer in urine, and it can live a lot longer in semen. So there's very high potential for sexual transmission of this disease from a man to a woman. And it's particularly interesting because 80% of people who get infected don't have any symptoms. So a man can go and get infected, not ever know it, and then unknowingly transmit it to his sexual partner after that. So it becomes a bit more of an interesting area because of that.
Right, but if it's transmitted by the male to the female in terms of sexual intercourse, then what happens if that female gets pregnant?
Well, especially in the first trimester, it can be a huge problem. In Brazil, it's estimated that about 1 in 100 women who got infected, mostly in the first trimester, got children that were microcephalic. So it's not an enormously high risk, but it's a risk that we really don't want to deal with.
But when you say in the first trimester, is that to do with infection via sexual intercourse or an infection where the woman is bitten by a mosquito in the first trimester?
Doesn't matter, either case.
I see. So, and we don't have a breakdown on that. We don't know the extent to which sexual transmission versus mosquito bites?
No, I mean, there hasn't been enough cases to be able to really get a good handle on that. So it can happen either way, but the important thing is in the first trimester of pregnancy. After that, it goes down quite significantly.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Peter Cotona, who is a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He's worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and as an EIS officer studying viral diseases and doing epidemic investigations. And he has held appointments at Louisiana State University's National Center for Biomedical Research and Training and the Los Angeles County Emergency Management Services Agency. So, given the vulnerable period that we understand now, do we know what the connection then between the Zika virus and microcephaly?
Well, CDC's come out and said they have confirmed that there is a connection. So it's not thought about as a possibility anymore. The actual connection is there. And as I said, in Brazil, it's probably 1 in 100 women infected in pregnancy that get it. Other places, it's thought to be less than 1 in 100, but still unacceptably high.
Well, but you can't quantify that in terms of what it must be like for a woman to be pregnant and to not know, right? Whether, I mean, just one mosquito bite could have done it. And who knows what kind of mosquito bites you, and particularly in the tropics, people are bitten all the time. And of course, we're not immune here in the United States, are we not? Isn't the Aedes aegypti mosquito slowly migrating north?
Well, it's present in the kind of the southern half of the country. So we do have that mosquito. And interestingly, unlike the malaria mosquito, this mosquito bites during the day. The malaria mosquito kind of bites after the sun goes down, so you're less likely to be outdoors and exposed. So this makes it even more tricky because people are outdoors during the day. And if you're in a poorer area, a poorer country, you don't have air conditioning, you don't have screens in your house, you're going to have much more likelihood of getting bitten by one of these mosquitoes that not only transmits this disease, but transmits a whole score of other diseases as well, like dengue fever and chikungunya and yellow fever even is transmitted by the same mosquito.
But then, given what you said about the difference in, say, the Caribbean and Central and South America and the United States in terms of screens, et cetera, for mosquitoes, surely then you get back to the idea or notion that surely mosquito eradication seems like the best option here, particularly if we don't have the science in yet, the research is not done yet in terms of a vaccine. So in the short term, shouldn't we be doing everything we can to eradicate mosquitoes? And if people get bitten, is there any way to do a quick test to see whether they have Zika?
Well, it's very hard to have total eradication of mosquitoes, especially in certain areas where the mosquito likes to live and has good habitat, finds those old tires, for example, that have a little bit of water sitting in them. So it's really hard to eradicate all mosquitoes. But, you know, a lot of things you mentioned at the beginning about what we've done wrong in the past. And one of the things, for example, was DDT. We basically used DDT. It worked very well. There was some resistance to it. There was some carcinogenicity issues with it. So we decided we were not going to use it anymore. But DDT is still an excellent, excellent insecticide to use. And it's all the issues with DDT have been outside when it was sprayed over large areas. And the spraying for this particular situation is more indoor spraying. And there's really virtually no data to indicate that DDT is a big problem when it's sprayed indoors. So that's one of the issues that's occurred over time, that we've kind of limited ourselves with what we can use in addition to whatever resources we allocate for its use.
So perhaps, again, that might have been what the Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Margaret Chan, was referring to when she said that there was a massive policy failure that dropped the ball on mosquito control in the 1970s. Would that have been a time when DDT was being used and then was banned?
I'm not sure exactly when the banning of it was, but it was around that time.
Mm-hmm. So there seems to be a link there then.
P- Possibly. I mean, possibly that's because it was very cheap. It was very effective. There were resistance issues with some mosquitoes, but it wasn't a terrible problem. So it was one of the issues, I think, that may have been referred to.
Right. So let's try and figure out then the migration of this Zika virus, because Zika itself is the name of the forest that where it was first discovered, I believe, in 1947. I think, is it in Zimbabwe or Tanzania or somewhere?
Uganda,
okay. So that's where it comes from. And then it moved for some reason to the Easter Island and then got into South America, then Central America, and now it's heading into the United States. So
yeah, I mean, it started in East Africa. It went to a few other Asian areas like Indonesia, and then it kind of took a turn and went across the Pacific, and an island hopped from one place to another, caused a few outbreaks. One place had an outbreak of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is another neurological consequence of this infection. But it didn't really pick up a lot of steam until it got to Brazil. And part of the problem there was that Brazil is in an absolute mess. I mean, economically it's a mess, politically it's a mess. The water supply is really problematic. A city like São Paulo of, 20 million people is running out of water. Restaurants don't have enough water to clean dishes. You know, hydroelectric plants don't have enough water to be able to make electricity. And so the mosquitoes have had a very, very good time breeding in areas like this. And that's been the amplifier focus to kind of get it really pushed up in Brazil so that it could really have a kickstart to go north from there.
So, well, by the way, though, how come that virus has been in the forests of Uganda since 1947 and there hasn't been a huge outbreak of Zika in Uganda itself?
Well, maybe there has, but we just haven't noticed it. It's a very good question because there were virtually no cases reported for many decades after the first case was actually found. And why that is really subject to conjecture, but it may be that people are infected at a very early age and don't have any symptoms, don't have any problem with it, and it's long before the age that they would ever get pregnant. So maybe nobody really paid much attention. It kind of fit into the background noise of people getting sick in that part of Africa anyway. But it's a good question, and really there are virtually no cases reported for 20, 30 years until it started moving a little bit to the east, to Indonesia and places like that.
So were there any cases of microcephaly, though, in Uganda?
No, not that I'm aware of at all.
So when did the first evidence of that link between Zika and microcephaly, when did that emerge? Only recently in Brazil?
Yeah, as far as I know, it was first recognized in Brazil.
And again, this is where I find it hard to understand the actions or the inactions of the Congress and not moving on it, because it's got to be one of the most horrible things for a pregnant woman to go through, isn't it? I mean, it's just so cruel to think that that uncertainty, that you don't know whether the child that you're going to have is going to have a shrunken head.
Well, you'll know at 20 weeks with an ultrasound, 20 weeks of pregnancy. So you won't have to wait forever for it. But it's a problem. I mean, you either pay the price now or you pay the price later. You know, one case of microcephaly is extremely expensive to take care of for a lifetime. And it's the same argument that's made for hepatitis C medications. They're cost about $80,000 per course. They're very, very highly effective. And the excuse is, well, if you don't do it now, one case of hepatitis C will cost you, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it's the same argument that you can make. And, you know, who's to decide how much money is enough? You know, is $1.9 billion enough to request by the United States, or is that too little? You know, it's really hard to put a quantification of how much money is needed, how much do you take from somewhere else. Very, very complicated decisions that most of us are ill-equipped to be able to opine on.
Right, but you can make the obvious observation that $1.9 billion is going to do a lot more than $622 million, which is what the House is offering up. And there was a floor debate and a 241 to 184 vote along party lines that essentially has created this gridlock in the House.
And, you know, these are political issues more than they are medical or epidemic issues. You know, it's been so politicized that's the way that it goes. But, you know, it's not based on science. It's based on a political conviction, which is quite unfortunate.
Right, but if notwithstanding that it's all about politics, and we know we have a broken government and we have gridlock, but the arguments that you made, particularly about the cost later if it's not dealt with, you cited hepatitis, but in this case, once people get infected with Zika, you know, having a lifelong expense of a deformed child is an enormous expense, not to mention the heartbreak involved. So have those arguments been made, do you think, to the Congress?
I don't know how much those arguments are made, but that's certainly where the administration is coming from in terms of requesting that money.
So basically the argument being that you're being penny wise and pound foolish.
I think so. I mean, that's the argument that the White House makes. And, you know, agreed, this is something that you're either going to have to pay for now or, you know, if things get really bad, you're going to have a disaster lurking. I mean, you know, if you look, for example, at the World Bank estimates, you know, they value the annual global cost of a severe pandemic at close to $600 billion. So you have to be careful at how you spend your money and how quickly you get on board. We have a long history of spending too little too late for outbreaks, going back over all of history. Going back to Ebola just a few years ago, where we just spent too little too late. And hopefully we can learn something in the future about this. And what about the next outbreak that happens? You know, what if it doesn't wait for Zika to subside to happen, and all of a sudden you need more money for another outbreak? You know, we'd be even less equipped to handle that. So it's something we have to give a lot of thought to and not just go into political bickering.
Well, Dr. Peter Katona, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Glad to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Peter Katona, who is a clinical professor of medicine in infectious diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. He has worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and as an EIS officer studying viral diseases and doing epidemic investigation. And he's held appointments at Louisiana State University's National Center for Biomedical Research and Training and the Los Angeles County Emergency Management Services Agency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.